Okay, good evening, everyone, and welcome to our next installment on our American Orthodox Judaism Rabbinate series, tracing the history of Orthodoxy in America. Been very gratified to have such wonderful feedback on the series on the whole, and of course, the unsolicited advice on all of the personalities that we omitted, but that gives us the opportunity to continue next year with more and more. So tonight we have the privilege of learning about, reviewing the extraordinary life and legacy of a really outstanding individual, Dr. Joseph Kamenetsky. By a show of hands, how many people knew Dr. Joe? By a show of hands, how many were related to Dr. Joe? Okay. So essentially, so far what we've established is that I'm grossly inadequate to be presenting. But nevertheless, we'll give it a try. And any insights or compliments that you can offer what we're going to study about his life, you're certainly invited to do so, because the point is that we are all moved and inspired by his legacy. We're not gathered simply to review or recall a figure of distant history, but to be able to draw from who he was and to inspire ourselves in the present as well. Okay, his early years. He was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1911. His family was struggling at the time. It was a time it was difficult for Jews to succeed, and you'll see why that's relevant in a moment. He was one of nine children. He was the oldest son. He passed away. He was niftar on Erev Rosh Chodesh Nisan, March 17th, 1999. He attended public school his first year that he was eligible to go to school, but already in his youth and his infancy, his father determined that public school was not the place to raise a Jewish child. It would not promise a bright Jewish future and Jewish continuity. However, as I mentioned, it was a difficult time. The family struggled financially, and therefore what it took, and I want to just give something perspective right now, because today, and I don't mean to minimize in the least the great cost of Jewish education today and the extraordinary sacrifices that young families are asked to make in order to be able to afford it, but today a family will shry Nebuch, I was only able to go to Orlando Yeshiva Week. I couldn't go to Croatia. I couldn't go to Cancun. What I have to give up to be Moser Nefesh for Jewish education. Dr. Joseph Kamenetsky's father had to sell his home in order to have the money to be able to send his child, and I imagine other of his children, for that Jewish education. But that's what he was willing to do. And it's no wonder that Dr. Joe grew up and ultimately would become this incredible a conduit who would live a life, a mission to build day schools and transform this country, because embedded and imbued with him at such a young age already was the priority, the significance of a Jewish education. Example modeled by his parents, who were willing to make such a great sacrifice. Such a great sacrifice. It gives us a sense of perspective of what we're willing to go up for that which we really care about. They moved from East New York to Brownsville, which was a thriving... I'd never been to Brownsville, but I understand it was a thriving a community at the time, where he attended Yeshivas of Chaim Berlin for elementary school, Talmudic Academy on the Lower East Side for high school. This is a picture of Chaim Berlin, it should say on Prospect Place, early on in Chaim Berlin's history. In later high school years, Brownsville friends and he founded a school of Jewish studies on Shabbos afternoon. They called it the AZBO, the Anshei Tzedek Boys Organization. They ran intensive classes in Hebrew, Chumash, Nach, Jewish history, and it became a meeting place for B'nai Akiva youth group activities. This is a picture of the young Israel of Brownsville, where he grew up and where he was so active, and where he introduced this youth organization. You can't zoom in on my PowerPoint. If you could, you would see that on both sides the signs show it now houses two churches. Brownsville is no longer a thriving, active, observant Jewish community. But still, in the windows above the signs showing the two churches, there is a Jewish star in each of those windows, which of course depict the fact that it used to be home to young Israel. Again, at a very young age, Dr. Kamenetsky exhibited this leadership quality that he and his friends determined that the next generation needed to be inspired with a passionate Jewish knowledge, passionate Jewish living, and they therefore, on their own, introduced this AZBO, the Anshei Tzedek Boys Organization. He learned leadership skills, he honed public speaking, he gave speeches, drushes in his teenage years. He was invited to speak already at that young Israel of Brownsville. In his memoir, which we're going to draw from extensively tonight, called Memorable Encounters, A Torah Pioneer's Glimpse of Great Men and Years of Challenge, he will draw from it. Here he has the quote. Jewish life was much less polarized at that time than it is now, with people of all types accommodating each other in a rich interchange. Differences did exist, but dogmatic ideological boundaries were largely undefined and undrawn. The traditional world of yeshiva-oriented Jews crossed paths frequently with the worlds of Mizrahi, Young Israel, and the nascent community of Yeshiva College. He nostalgically remembered, and we can long for the return of such a time. You can imagine then that they were happy to be alive, grateful to have survived the greatest calamity the Jewish people ever faced. And in the basking in the honeymoon of that survival, nobody had the energy to focus on the differences. Nobody was busy judging or marginalizing or excluding some other segment of the Jewish community. But he recalled nostalgically that in Brownsville growing up, these communities overlapped. They weren't as polarized. Certainly the differences, the distinctions were important and they mattered. But those ideological boundaries were undefined and undrawn in his world. And therefore, you were able to have in one shul, in one community, you could have those who identified with Mizrahi, Zionists, and Young Israel, Yeshiva College, and the Hasidish and Hungarian Yeshiva community. They all overlapped, and it wasn't as threatening to one another. We can certainly long for the return of that time. He became active in Hapoel HaMizrahi. Hapoel HaMizrahi, the young Zionist observant movement, preaching love for all Jews, love of Eretz Yisrael, and love of Torah. These three pillars, which are, of course, the ideological foundation that Torah inspires for us all. Am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, and Torah Yisrael, a Jewish people longing to live a Jewish way of life, a Torah, in our homeland. They were the core of Hapoel HaMizrahi. They're not only what he learned about, but it's what he's taught and what he spread at a young age. Dr. Revel announced they were opening up a yeshiva college as he was graduating high school. Now today, the question is, are you going to YU, are you going to Torah, are you going to Landers, are you going to this, are you going to that, are you going to the other? But in those days, there was no Jewish college. Jews were not welcome in many colleges, and there certainly was no college that itself was informed and inspired by Jewish values and ideals. So there was great excitement when Dr. Revel announced that they were going to be opening up yeshiva college. His father was struck with Parkinson's, and he had to give up, and it wasn't able to work. There were nine children at home, plus a niece and a nephew, whom his father brought to America from Slonim, which was Dr. Joe Kamenetsky's father's hometown. And these were the years of the Great Depression. He had to work to help his family at that time. He became a member of that first class at Yeshiva College, and he graduated magna cum laude in 1932. The first graduating class of Yeshiva College, which then was subsumed under the Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Seminary. It was under the banner of the yeshiva as a whole. One of his teachers and one of his role models in Yeshiva College was Rabbi Leo Young. Those who attended last week, 2 weeks ago, Rabbi Moskowitz spoke about Rabbi Leo Young and his great contribution to Orthodoxy in America. He was one of his teachers, and Dr. Joe would walk him home after class to the subway. And in those walks, on those conversations, Rabbi Young would inquire about his family and how they were doing, and he shared his father had Parkinson's. He was one of nine siblings, a niece and a nephew living with them. They were struggling. And he recalled very fondly, he writes in the Memorable Encounters, how Rabbi Young, in order to be able to help him, said that he had two daughters who needed someone to tutor them in Judaic studies. Would Dr. Joe be willing to come? And in that way, Rabbi Young was able to help him. Upon graduating, he became the principal of the afternoon school of the Jewish Center in Manhattan, where Rabbi Young was the rabbi. And later he became the assistant rabbi under Rabbi Leo Young. Interesting, in the articles I read, it said he was the assistant rabbi. In his own memoirs, he said he basically functioned like the assistant rabbi, even though he didn't have that title. Essentially, he was complementing and supplementing what Rabbi Young was doing. He was also editing the Jewish Center Bulletin, writing articles, seeing the publication through. He considered himself a great student of Rabbi Young, who he recalls fondly as well. Rabbi Young taught him how to live a life, how to have class, how to have dignity, esteem, how to be regal, how to live with a high sense of class is something that he learned from Rabbi Young. 1937, he left yeshiva to go to Teachers College at Columbia University. He got his doctorate in education from Columbia Teachers College, and then on was known as, affectionately known as, Dr. Joe. 1940, he got married. There is a wedding picture in the bottom right to Selma or Shalamis, known differently to different people. He describes he was busy helping support his family. As we mentioned, his father was sick. He had all these siblings. He was a newlywed. He was so focused on Teachers College, Jewish education, leadership in Hapoel HaMizrahi, that he was not able to attend the rigorous smicha program of Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan at the time, so he did not get smicha from Reitz, even though he graduated Yeshiva College, and he got his PhD from Teachers College, but he did have something which was popular at the time. There were great Talmidei Chachamim living in the New York area, and he did get two personal smichas, two private smichas, from two of those great Talmidei Chachamim. So he was Rabbi Dr. Joe Kamenetsky. In the early 1930s, while still at Reitz, he was part of a small group. I really enjoyed this part. He was part of a small group who gathered to study Mesilas Yesharim in one of the dorm rooms at Yeshiva University at the very early stages of Yeshiva College. Who were his classmates? Who were his chevra? With whom did he hang out at Yeshiva College of Yeshiva University? Well, they gathered in the room of Rav Avigdor Miller Zatzal. And among his group were Rav Nosson Wachtfogel. Anyone know who he went on to become? The Mashkiach of Beis Medrash Gavoh of Lakewood Yeshiva, Rav Avigdor Miller, another classmate, there's a picture of the two of them on the top, Rav Mordechai Gifter, the Rosh Yeshiva of Telz, and others, the who's who of Rosh Yeshiva, of prominent yeshivas of the Orthodox world, who mostly disassociated with Yeshiva University, but themselves were graduates of Yeshiva College, and this was quite a prominent and distinguished, quite an esteemed chevra that he identified and associated with. And I found it fascinating also in Yeshiva College, Reitz, which saw itself as a continuation of Volozhin. This was before Soloveitchik's and Brisk, but it was a continuation of Volozhin. I guess they didn't put a lot of emphasis on Musar. So when they wanted to study Musar, they did so clandestinely hiding in a dorm room. Now, I also did things in my dorm room, but gathering to study Mesilas Yesharim and Musar probably wasn't it. Maybe by college it was. They did so. Who taught them? Rav Yaakov Yosef Herman. You're familiar with the book All for the Boss? That's who they got to come teach in their dorm room. This incredible chevra, you can imagine. Rav Nosson Wachtfogel, Rav Avigdor Miller, Rav Mordechai Gifter, and others. And at that time, while they were busy learning Mesilas Yesharim in Yeshiva College dorm, they became aware that Rav Isaac Sher of the Slobodka Yeshiva was in the time in America. He was living in New York. And they went in order to be able to go study and to learn from him. And they would go every Motzei Shabbos, every Saturday night in Yeshiva College. They made their way to Brooklyn from YU, and they would go study with Rav Isaac Sher until he returned back to Slobodka, back to Europe. Dr. Joe maintained his very close relationship with Rav Sher, this great Musar personality, and in fact, he continued to correspond with him even after Rav Isaac Sher went back to Slobodka, went back to Europe. He continued to be in touch. He continued to correspond with him. By the way, most of the pictures of Dr. Joe Kamenetsky, he's got that delicious-looking pipe hanging out of his lips. So that's him with Rav Gifter in the picture on the top. Now, though the Rav was only beginning to give shir at YU after he had already graduated and after he had already left, Dr. Joe described considering himself a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik. He read everything the Rav wrote, he listened to tapes of the Rav Shirim as much as possible, and he considered the Rav to be his second great rabbinic influence and mentor. The two big rabbinic influences in his life, Rav Isaac Sher, the great Baal Musar of Slobodka, and Rabbi Soloveitchik, of course, professionally, Rabbi Young had a great impact on him as well. He writes in the book, although Rabbi Soloveitchik was not an active member of the advisory board of the Rosh Yeshiva Torah Mesorah, he was respected as a peer. I remember once meeting Rav Avram Kalmanovitz, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir, at the RCA headquarters. We're going to be reading a lot of things today. We're reading a lot of things that you would never be able to read or think would happen today. It's actually a sad commentary on what happened in the world. The more comfortable and safe and secure we got, the more we were able to fight with one another and draw those battle lines. We can long for such a time. So the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir of Kalmanovitz was at the RCA headquarters, and when asked where he was going, he said, we, the Rabbinic Advisory Board of Torah Mesorah, we have an inyan, we want to get Rav Soloveitchik's opinion. We're dealing with an inyan. We, now who's on that board, we'll see momentarily, are the who's who of Gedolei Yisrael of America. Rav Huttner, Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Moshe, Rav Ruderman, but we are going to the RCA headquarters because we have a difficult inyan and we're not willing to proceed without consulting first with the Rav, with Rabbi Soloveitchik. He became executive director of Manhattan Day School. Dr. Joe was the president of Yeshiva Kumnai Alumni Association, and he got involved. There's a whole section in the book we're not going to review now, but my dear teacher, Rabbi Rakefet, as a long talk online, if you want to hear his take on this, the search for the second president of Yeshiva University after Dr. Revel, and as the president of the Yeshiva College Alumni Association, Dr. Kamenetsky was involved in the search, and it was a fascinating time. He did not support He thought Dr. Revel was an amazing teacher, and he underestimated Dr. Revel's leadership. He admits himself in the book. He supported, there was apparently a big campaigning that was going on over that presidency, but he was involved. In 1946, he was recruited by Rabbi Sender Gross and Rabbi Bernard Goldenberg. Rabbi Sender Gross should be familiar to many of us in our community. How do we know him? As Mrs. Kanner's father. To become the educational director of Torah U'Mesorah. Torah U'Mesorah was this new organization that was launched by Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovich. We call him Rav Shraga Feivel, the great Malamed, the great Mechanech, the great Rosh Hashiva. He called himself Mr. Mendelovich. It's a whole separate topic, and I don't know if he's on our list for this year. Did we cover him? Okay, Mirtz Hashem for next year. But he didn't hesitate to hire Dr. Kamenetsky. So Rav Sender Gross and Bernard Goldenberg had seen his leadership at the Young Israel of Brownsville. I'd heard him speak and knew his leadership and his ambition within Hapoel Mizrahi, thought that he had what it took to be able to help this effort, this new movement called Torah Mesorah, and recruited him to join, which he did as the educational director. He recalled fondly and with tremendous gratitude and admiration that Rav Shraga Feivel didn't hesitate to hire a YU graduate who was the national vice president of Hapoel HaMizrahi. And he writes in his memoir, "His bigness moved me profoundly, and in return motivated me to give him and Torah Mesorah my utmost loyalty. Although I felt sympathetic to the ideals of both the pure yeshivish and modern Orthodox worlds, I was typed as a modern by some of the Torah Mesorah Kehila. I shall never forget how one really great Rosh Yeshiva railed against me, exclaiming, 'We don't need the PhDs and their semicolons.'" Apparently that's an insult, to be a semicolon. To know how to punctuate properly is a form of an insult. You know, this speaks to me with each of the personalities that I've been privileged to present to you. I talk about what I've learned from them and how they resonate for me. And certainly this speaks for me, and I think speaks for our whole community, as we try to be a place that is a melting pot, diversity and unity, the ability to fit and feel comfortable in multiple and parallel worlds, drawing the best of everything that's out there and trying not to be typed or not to be squeezed into a box or to be put with a label. But he did remember, this is a picture in the early days of Torah Mesorah, of Dr. Kamenetsky with Rabbi Sender Gross and Rabbi Bernard Goldenberg, as they were beginning to launch this movement. That's Rav Shraga Feivel on the top. Day school movement began. This is the background in America. Because for us today, you say, what's a Jewish community without a day school? What's the big deal? Day schools, what's the big deal? Successful, thriving, large Jewish communities have not one day school, competing day schools. And if we think here in South Florida, out of town, we have the luxury of several day schools. The shades grow even more diverse. You go into more metropolitan Jewish neighborhoods, and the nuanced differences between the schools become even smaller and smaller, and yet every group needs their own day school. So day schools are something for us that we take for granted. A Jewish community has a kosher pizza store and a day school. It has an Erev, and it has a mikvah and kasher, a day school, and it has kosher restaurants. But that was not at all the case, certainly not at that time. What was happening? The day school movement began amidst the mood of prevailing gloom. Half the world's Jews had been exterminated over a period of 6 years, and the great Torah centers of Europe were no more. In America, it was almost universally assumed that Torah observance and learning were relics of the past. Not only was Kaddish being said for the 6 million, Kaddish was being recited for Judaism and for Torah and for the future of Orthodoxy as we knew it. The Jewish people, the Torah world, was limping, severely wounded, amputated. And the idea that it would one day thrive again was anachronistic to most. The times were hardly propitious for a movement of Jewish revival. First and second generation Americans just beginning to enter the mainstream of American life derided the idea of a Jewish day school as undemocratic and un-American, an affront to the ethos of the American melting pot. This is in an article in Jerusalem Post 1999 that Jonathan Rosenblum wrote about Dr. Kamenetsky. And he's describing what was happening in America at the time. We heard about it earlier this year from one of our scholars in residence, that in most American communities, even those who were Torah observant, still, they saw Jewish education and going to break away from the public school movement. It's undemocratic. It's un-American. You're going to label our children, the next generation, greeners. They're not going to be able to assimilate and fit in. They won't get jobs. They won't be safe. We won't be able to thrive. And therefore, we have to forfeit and concede that idea, that dream, that hope of a Jewish education, and simply participate in and blend in to the public school option. That's what was going on. But Dr. Kamenetsky writes very differently in his memoir. Something started to happen in the end of the 40s. Some will say it was the founding of the State of Israel, which restored hope and pride to the aching Jewish hearts. Others claim it was the emigration of Hungarian and Hasidic Jews to America. There were various forces at work, all of which brought forth a drang, a great desire for identity with Torah and Jewish ideals and values. From there, the day school movement took off. It's very fascinating to contrast the two descriptions of what was happening in America. One of doom and gloom, one of the demise of the Jewish people, one of the hopelessness, and the other, his perspective. We can understand now why he was able to accomplish everything he did because of the lens through which he looked at the world. But he described, no, something extraordinary was happening. Yes, half of our people were wiped out. But now in the end of the 1940s, with the founding of the State of Israel, it was a resurrection of those dead. It was a new beginning, a redemptive era of hope and pride and aching Jewish hearts. And the Hungarian Hasidic Jews coming to America brought back a bread, a fire, a passion, a commitment to tradition and to education. And the confluence of those events, of those things, for Dr. Joe represented a launching point of this movement and a promising background against which the Jewish people, Jewish education could thrive. Shraga Feivel founded a teacher training program called Eish Das, Fire of Faith, which was led by his students, Rabbi Gross and Rabbi Goldenberg. In fact, I'm going to share with you, Dr. Joe wrote an article in Tradition in the 1970s, and he titled the article, A Program for the Day School Movement in the 70s and Beyond. It's really a very prescient article in many ways. We're going to come back to it. But in it, he talks about exactly this movement. He writes, during the past two summers, I'm reading to you now from this article in Tradition, not from the PowerPoint. During the past two summers, we in the Torah Masorah have conducted a pilot program in the conquest of communities. Sorry, that's where he's talking about the seed program. Hold on. Still going on today. Here. The amalgamation of intensive Torah study and the most modern and effective teaching tools and methods will no doubt present many problems to the B'nai Torah whom we hope to attract to our schools. Torah Masorah is now involved in such a pilot project known as the Eish Das Teacher Training Fellowship Program. This program sets up special chinuch kolo whereby advanced students of Torah are provided with a unique course of study, giving them understanding of modern techniques while they pursue their intense Torah studies in a kolo of their choice. The B'nai Torah will have to have a greater knowledge of the latest educational hardware, such as program learning and teaching machines, as well as new teaching techniques, including team teaching and open classroom, and he goes on. So they founded this teacher training. How are they going to make Jewish education, how are they going to make schools, Jewish schools, vibrant places that inspire, that attract Jewish students, that can compete with public schools? So they founded this Eish Das. Rav Shraga Feivel also got the backing of tremendous lay leaders, as well as the who's who of the Rabbanim. He recruited lay leaders like Samuel Furstein of Brookline, who was president until his death in 1983, Irving and Amos Bunim, and the list of who were the lay leaders of, we're going to see some letterhead of Torah Masorah, and you'll see the letterhead, the lay leaders who were involved in Torah Masorah were the who's who of the American Orthodox movement. He also set up a rabbinical administrative board. Rav Aaron Kotler was the head, but also were Rav Reuven Grzovsky of Torah Vidas, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Ruderman, Rav Moshe, Rav Futner, Rav Elia Meir Bloch, Rav Mordechai Katz, Rav Aaron Kalmanovitz of Mir, Rav David Lishitz, and the Mashkiach Rav Lessen of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. What's interesting is in the pictures, you see how, first of all, on top, that's Irving Bunim, and on the bottom, standing with several of these Gedolei Yisrael, is Dr. Joe, who the pictures themselves depict the casual relationship, not a disrespectful one, but the level of closeness that he shared with them in their efforts working. Dr. Joe served for 2 years before becoming the director of the entire organization in 1948 upon the passing of Rav Shraga Feivel. So Rav Shraga Feivel had this vision. He launched the movement called Torah U'Masorah, trying to provide Jewish education for Jews wherever they were. He joined as the educational director, Dr. Kamenetsky, and 2 years later, when Rav Shraga Feivel passed away, he took over as the director. His self-sacrifice, his mesiras nefesh for Torah education, was absolutely unbelievable. It was unbelievable. He traveled the width and breadth of this country, and he did not do so as we do today. Today he would have been a million-mile member of every airline. He would be upgraded for free. He'd get a live flat seat and a massage and unlimited champagne. And who wouldn't want to, you put the kids to bed and give a bath. I've got to go save the Jewish people, and I'll be back when I'm done. In those days, that's not how one traveled around. I was talking to Rabbi Levine earlier this evening, who remembers in Charleston, Dr. Joe taking several trains to be able to come. He would take trains to get there, stay there for a few hours or at most one night, take trains to the next community, the next community, the next community, hold meetings, try to convince people, found a new school. The Mesiras Nefesh, the self-sacrifice, because what he believed was so critically important to be able to protect and preserve a future of the Jewish people, and just how threatened we were without it. And when he returned to New York from one of his trips, he was more likely to receive criticism than accolades from those who sat comfortably on the sidelines while he built the future of American Judaism. They criticized him for the concessions to reality that had to be made. You see, in the luxury of a large and thriving Jewish community that can afford the highest standards, this is something we still see today in kashrus, in school, in a lot of different arenas and areas, he went out and he saw the Jews where they were living. And you know what? If you'd have standards, we'll see in a moment a few examples, they would never be able to found that day school. There were concessions that had to be made. And therefore, he faced opposition. He faced criticism. People who sat on the sidelines and were not doing anything to ensure Jewish continuity and Jewish future had no hesitation, as is true still today. The passive people who were spectators to the unfolding of Jewish destiny only participated when they had a criticism to offer, when they had opposition or protest to offer, when they wanted to explain why the pioneer hero was doing it all wrong and this is what he should be doing better. And that's what he faced. He didn't come home to parades celebrating his Mesiras Nefesh and all of his effort. He had a slogan, that's Honolulu, for the compromises that had to be made to bring a school into existence in far-flung communities. And yet, the compromises did not become engraved in stone as if they were the preferred path, so that schools and communities continued to grow spiritually. He confronted a lot of resistance, opposition, and pushback, and yet, his enthusiasm, and his passion, his commitment, they never waned. They never waned. How many times do you hear a no and you keep going? How much criticism and pushback can you take? How much controversy around your name? And yet, it never deterred him. He remained laser-focused on his mission, which was to bring Jewish education across America. This is one of the fascinating things about his life, one of the many things we can learn from. Dr. Joe Kamenetsky was American-born, university-trained, a leader of Hapoel Mizrahi, but he served these European Torah personalities loyally. He adopted their philosophies, he made them his own. He was able to navigate and weave that very fine opening between being this American-born, university-educated, and yet connect with, develop a close relationship with, collaborate with, and execute the vision of European-born Gedolei Yisrael. And his memoirs focus on that relationship. What I share with you about his own history is just the beginning of the book. But the book I highly recommend, Memorable Encounters, it's available online, or if you speak to Shimi. But I highly recommend it. It's mostly his stories interacting with Gedolei Yisrael and talking about what it was like to have this incredible close relationship and their partnership in all that they did. The Gedolim, this is also extraordinary. They trusted his judgment. They were willing to make compromises based on his assessment. So for example, these Gedolei Yisrael, the notion of boys and girls in a school together was foreign. Foreign to their experience in Europe and foreign to their hashkafa, their ideology. What do they want to see happen on these new shores? And yet, he was able to persuade them that if you're going to insist on that, you're not going to have day schools in America. Rabbi Levine shared with me, he vividly remembers a Torah Masorah conference at the Pineview Hotel, where before Mincha Shabbos, on the long Shabbos afternoon, there was questions and answers with Dr. Joseph Kamenetsky, and one of the people asked him the question, what is the criteria, what defines a Torah Masorah school? That was the question. We don't know, we wouldn't want to know what the answer would be by Torah Masorah today. But what defines, what qualifies, what are the criteria of a Torah Masorah school? And he answered very simply. He said, Torah Misinai. If they believe the Torah is divinely given, they're in. It doesn't matter how the denomination, how they affiliate, or what they say, who their principal is, what kind of yarmulke they wear, co-ed, single-sex. It didn't matter. None of those other variables mattered. He said, to be able to create as big a net, as broad a net as possible for Torah Umasorah, at least at the time, the criteria to join were Torah Misinai. So here you add this incredible relationship between the two, which I think is one of the major takeaways of his life. He, the American-born university student, yeshiva college graduate, Hapoel Mizrahi vice president, is able to nevertheless have this close, intimate relationship with European Gedolei Yisrael, and to execute their vision on the one hand, and they on the other hand were persuaded and compelled by the arguments he made because he was the one making those trips. He was the one who was in the field. I love this picture on the bottom right because the connection with these Gedolei Yisrael and the who's who are in that picture, it's clear the relationship that he shared. This is in his memoirs. Although I felt sympathetic to the ideals of both the pure Yeshivish and modern Orthodox worlds, I was typed as modern by some. In truth, those early years, I did indeed find myself living ideologically in two worlds. The modern Orthodox milieu of Yeshiva University and the more traditional Yeshiva world of my early Brownsville days and of Torah Mesorah. I was criticized now and then by religiously conservative people who objected to any hint of ideological flexibility on the day school initiative, while at the same time, many of my former friends at Yeshiva called me a black hatter. Yet the Lord was good to me and enabled me to maintain a careful equilibrium between the two worlds and to work with both for the sake of Torah. That in itself is an outstanding comment of who he was, and I think a model for us to draw the best from all worlds and to be able to do all of it for the sake of Torah. He was a true visionary, revolutionary, personally responsible for the founding of countless day schools. For the next 35 years after he succeeded Rav Shraga Feivel, he traveled the width and breadth of the United States with a mission to establish Jewish day schools. He then served as the director emeritus after retiring for another 6 years. 41 years he served in the leadership and this movement called Torah Mesorah. At his funeral, Baruch Mordechai Yizrachi told the story. 1973, he was in a room with Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal. And Dr. Joe walked into the room and Rav Moshe stood up. Rav Moshe was the undisputed Gadol Hador. And he stood up when Dr. Kamenetsky walked in a room. And Rav Yizrachi asked him, why'd you stand up for this man? And Rav Moshe said to him, quote, "This man has established Torah in America. There would not be Torah in America if not for Dr. Joe Kamenetsky, and I don't think there could be a greater endorsement than Rav Moshe Feinstein, and not only Rav Moshe Feinstein saying that, but standing up for him as well. He translated his love, his dreams into action, execution, and change. It began with a dream, and here was what he said. Every Jewish community that has a minimum of 5,000 Jews needs a Jewish school. Again, today, we would say it's a luxury, but even those school places with less, Lubavitcher Rebbe Zatzal would send a shliach out to any community that had one Jew. And when challenged, all the resources and the Mesiris Nefesh are going to send a shliach out for one Jew, Lubavitcher Rebbe said, let me ask you, if you have many children and one child goes to live in a certain community and you're worried about how well they're doing, would you not travel to go care for that one child? Every Jew is one of our children. And he sent the shliach everywhere. That's a luxury. Dr. Joe said, 5,000, population of 5,000 Jews, and needs a Jewish school. It seemed unrealistic. To many, to most, it seemed absolutely delusional. He was told by more than one leader, when hair grows in the palm of my hand, there will be a day school here. And children won't fit in, they won't get educated, they won't get jobs, they won't be American, it's undemocratic. Even though to us, it's like Jewish mom and apple pie, but at the time it wasn't. And he faced and he confronted great opposition, and nevertheless he persevered. At the time, there were only a handful of yeshivas and day schools in all of America. Mostly in New York, but also one in Baltimore and Chicago. A handful. You can count on two hands how many day schools there were in the 1940s, 50s, in all of America. Today there are over 600 with over 170,000 students. And that's to the credit of Dr. Joe Kamenetsky and Torah Mesorah, who many decades ago went and traveled with great self-sacrifice in order to launch and inspire those schools. How did he do it? Well, he collaborated with educators. And he took people who were in the field of education and he asked them, he couldn't go everywhere on his own. He sent people out. Now this slide, the next two slides, are personally very meaningful to me because Sam E. Aboff, the person who's at the center of this slide, is my grandfather, for whom my son is named, Shai Shmuel Yisrael. Now son of Shmuel is for my grandfather, Sam E. Aboff. And my mother shared with me many letters, but I only provided four of them with you, correspondence between Dr. Joseph Kamenetsky and my grandfather. It's a great point of pride. Shimi and Chani are here tonight. But the Kamenetsky-Goldberg friendships now, I think, are on their fifth generation with Shimi and my grandchildren, hopefully being friends one day. So this is a letter 1954 that Dr. Joe wrote to my grandfather. Dear Sam, thank you very much for accepting both assignments, the one in Crown Heights and the one in Shalameth. I've written to both groups. They were very happy to learn your acceptance. I'm sure they'll contact you directly from here and so on. Just an example, 1954, sending him out to represent, to promote, and to be able to support Jewish education. Here's one from 1958. One of the affiliates, the Hillel School of Denver, has turned to us for a representative to visit. them on November 23rd, 1958 to speak at their dinner and to serve at their school. They've requested someone with training in psychology and have expressed a special desire to have us send you, since they are acquainted with your regular column. Torah Masorah printed a regular magazine, and it had regular columnists in it, one of which was my grandfather. Their magazine was called The Jewish Parent, and his column was called The Problem Clinic. We do hope it'll be possible for you to make the trip. You'll see your mishpacha while you're there, because we had family in Denver. And the next is 1958. They're anxious to have you at the dinner. They'll pay a fine fee. Do you know what that fee was? I'm not sure. And then in 1971, why was it significant? And you'll allow me this point of personal pride to be able to share this. Why was it significant that he sent out my grandfather? Because my grandfather, and this is a congratulatory letter that Dr. Joe, his good friend, sent him in 1971, my grandfather went into public education, because as a Jew in America in those years and at that time, the only way not to be fired every Friday and look for a new job every Monday was if you worked in the public school system. That's why he became an educator in the public school system. And he started out on the bottom as an educator, and he rose ultimately to become the superintendent of the entire public school system of Elizabeth, New Jersey. We spoke about it when we studied Rabbi Teitz, and I had the picture of the naming of one of the public schools in Elizabeth Forum that Rabbi Teitz had attended. So this was a congratulatory letter, 1971. Although I rushed off a short and formal note to you on Friday, I want to put on the record officially, so to speak, our heartfelt congratulations to you upon the occasion of your being appointed the Superintendent of Schools of Elizabeth. We follow with great interest your consistent climb up the ladder in the educational system of your community, and we know how many pitfalls were placed in your way. All this makes the prize so much more meaningful, and our pride and congratulations more intense. May you have a Hatzlacha Rabba. All the best. Mazel Tov, Afreilich Chanukah. This was in December of 1971. So you can imagine, you have the superintendent of the entire public school system who's going and traveling out to Jewish communities and telling them, don't send your kids to public school. You need to found a Jewish school. You need to provide a Jewish education. You need to ensure Jewish continuity. For a Rebbe with a long beard who immigrated from Europe to say you need that, it's nice. But when somebody who himself has risen in the public school system is arguing why that's necessary, then it's even more compelling. I share this with you with personal pride, but I share it as an example of how he was able to not only lead, a great leader, he's able to garner followers. And he was able to put together a team of people who he was able to send out to these communities and to make those arguments. Dr. Hillel Goldberg in Denver recalls, quote, Dr. Kamenetsky could sell Jewish education not just because he believed in it, understood it, or cared. He did not found scores of Jewish state schools on these qualities alone. Still less on these qualities alone did he persuade others to give up potentially lucrative careers to found hundreds more day schools. The secret, his secret, Dr. Joseph Kamenetsky convinced you that you were building the school. You were the leader. You were the doer. You were making the sacrifice. You had the abilities. You were making the difference. He couldn't live in all of these communities simultaneously, so he would go to homes and have parlor meetings. He would recruit balabatim. He would make them plant the seeds of the idea, and so those lay leaders in each community, they actually believed it was their idea. They believed it was their school. They believed in it. This was his ability. A great leader is able to inspire other great leaders, and that's what he's able to do. He spoke about his word that he used was the mystique of Jewish education. If you could get the school going, others would want to be on board. So when others said, are you crazy? In America, it's undemocratic, it's un-American. We're immigrants, we're trying to fit in, we're trying to blend in, we're trying to assimilate. He said, no, there's a mystique. And if you could only launch the school, it will catch on. Everyone will want to be part of it. As the day school movement took off, the organization shifted from launching day schools to conferences, conventions, curriculum building, and consulting. He starts out this article, it's written in the 1970s. He says, after more than 30 years of dedicated hard work, Torah Masorah National Organization cannot escape the self-evident fact. Despite all we've accomplished, there's much to be done. We are aware, of course, of the unprecedented growth of the day school movement in the United States and Canada. This is his writing, his article. In 1930, there were only 30 day schools. Today, there are 430 with an additional 52 in Canada. And it's predicted by the late 70s, there'll be close to 500 schools in approximately 40 states and 135 communities. Jewish groups other than Orthodoxy have also established day schools. Solomon Schechter day schools under the auspices of the conservative movement continue to grow numerically. And recently, reformed day schools have been set up. Only the Zionists have failed to open up day schools in the United States, a fact which is paradoxical, since in England, many of the day schools are under Zionist sponsorship. From the beginning of the movement, the majority of the schools have been Orthodox, and he goes on and on. And he talks about in this article, it's very fascinating. You're reading an article describing what he thinks Jewish education needs in the 1970s, and much of it might as well have been written in the year 2020. He says, frankly, I found on my travels across the country a persistent resistance on the part of many parents to the teaching of Talmud. One way to improve the teaching of Talmud is to bring more B'nai Torah individually or as team teachers from the higher yeshivas into our schools. Possessed with idealism regarding Torah and Jewish living, these B'nai Torah can change the entire Torah complexion of a community and day school. Their devotion to Torah is so strong and their influence on their pupils is more profound than teachers of secular studies. What is preventing implementation of this idea on a large scale is that despite their idealism, B'nai Torah are reluctant to enter the field of teaching unless they can find schools and communities which stress similar ideas vis-a-vis Torah learning and observance. Perhaps the answer is advocated by many to send clusters of Kol Yungalait into communities so they can set up their own Kol and continue their studies while giving our students a more inspired and relevant understanding of Torah Sheba'al Peh. Fascinating. Really was prescient before the community Kol movement spread in America. He was already describing that. In our own community, some of our best educators in the various schools of our own community came through the community Kol. Yours truly came to this community through the community Kol, as this farm system to be able to bring people in and study, and then for them to grow and give back in the community. This is also fascinating, he writes in his vision of the 1970s. Together with intensive Torah study, there must be greater saturation of the secular studies with the Ruach of Torah in the day school. More concentrated coordination between the Hebrew and the secular department should be fostered. I've never forgotten the advice given me in the early days of the day school movement by a German Jewish educator who kept insisting that we build a seminary to train secular teachers of the day school. The time has surely come for such a program. They shouldn't be two distinct parts, Jewish studies and secular studies. The secular studies themselves should complement the Jewish studies. If you're learning science, it should be with a Torah slant. If you're learning literature, if you're learning whatever area, it should be with a Jewish slant. This was his argument. And again, the whole article is worth reading. I'm happy to share it or send a link to anyone who would like it. He was the complete package. Why was he successful? To give you some context, to give you some perspective, as we just shared those numbers, Dr. Joe Kamenetsky was to Jewish education what Lubavitcher Rebbe is to outreach. The image of Ufaratzta, of sending shlichim throughout the width and breadth of this country to inspire Jews wherever they are, he was doing it before it was popular. Nobody was thinking about it. He himself was traveling. He was Moser Nefesh. And he did it because of his love of Torah, his love of Gedolei Torah, his love of Jews of all backgrounds. American-born gave him an advantage. He can go to middle America, he can go anywhere in America, and he could comfortably and casually talk with anyone. He could forge a relationship. He had a charisma and a warmth, great oratory skills, and a persuasive personality, connected with people from all walks of life. He, of course, was a successful fundraiser. You can't start schools if you can't have the funds. A great educator. He was the life of the party. He took over at the dance floor at a simcha, Shemi was describing to me. He was the patriarch of his family, great sense of humor, but he told you straight, he spoke to you straight. He was committed to Torah learning, and in fact, as we'll see, in his later years in retirement, that's what he occupied himself with, was being able to sit and study Torah intensely. I want to just give you a flavor as we're beginning to wind down. We live in a time that we're able to have access to these personalities, to hear them. You can't help someone come alive as much as actually seeing their image and being able to hear it. So this is a video from a dinner that happened in Baltimore in the 1980s. It was honoring his mechutn, speaking about his mechutn, but before he does, he warms up the crowd a little bit. And I want to share that with you.
Sydney, major city in America, and many minor ones are there, also has day school. Tonight, Dr. Joseph Kamenetsky is not here in his role of Torah Masechus. He's here as Mechutin of Rav Lip, and he came here to extend his greetings, and it's our pleasure to hear from him now for his messages he wants to deliver to Rav Lip. Dr. Kamenetsky.
Yeshiva, Rabbi Weinberg, Russia Yeshiva, and friends. You know, I'm scared because Rav Shmuel Glazer said, don't speak more than 5 minutes. That always happens to me. I'll go across the country to Los Angeles. I'll schlep sich on the plane. I'll get there. They put me up to speak at 12 o'clock, which is 3 o'clock in the morning to me. And they say, please make it 10 minutes. I'm very much tempted to take another minute to tell you one of my great experiences in England, in the spirit of a Mlava Malkin. Everybody told me the English Jews, boy, they're stinks. You can't tell them any kind of story. Well, it was a big transatlantic discussion, dialogue, and so on and so forth. And the folks there in England want to know, what happens in America? How do you do it? So all I told him was one little story about a conference in Memphis, Tennessee. And we had a conference at one of the hotels there, and one of the girls from Memphis gets up and says to the folks, some of us who came from New York, I want you all to know that the meat in the joint is got kosher. Well, those English Jews cracked up. Now that I have you in a better mood, I'll take 7 minutes.
You got a little sense of his sense of humor, his charisma, his poise, his presence, and that was already in later years. His family, 5 children, Dona Nechama married to Rav Meir Steinhardt. Of course, our beloved Rav David Kamenetsky, Zichrono Livracha, was married to Suri, was the principal of Manhattan Day School 18 years, national director of NCSY, principal of Yeshiva in North Jersey, and of course, father of our beloved in our own community, Shimi Kamenetsky. His son Judah, Phyllis, married to Gedalia Reis, and Simi married to Rabbi Elizabeth Lift. There is a picture, Shimi, you'll forgive me for putting it in. That is a picture from Shimi and Beth's wedding, together with his grandparents, with Dr. Joe and his wife. Retirement. Upon retiring in 1980, at the age of 69, his wife moved to Yerushalayim. They lived in Sanhedria, and he spent most of his time there learning. That's how he wanted to spend his retirement. I think how someone spends their retired years says a lot about who we are and what we wish we could have done if we had more time in our working years. He was always among the first of the earliest minyan, the Beis Medrash that he davened at and learned at. And even in his later years, when his health began to fail, physically, mentally, struggled. Nevertheless, at 6:30 a.m. early minyan, he was among the first 10 that were there. In his last years, he used to tell people, I'm preparing for the final exam. That's why he was always in the Beis Medrash. He was always learning in those retired years. When asked why, he would say, I'm preparing for the final exam. At his funeral, here's a picture of his matzeva that Shimi visited just last week. Rav Nachman Bulman called him a bridge figure, in whose presence all differences between Jews melted away. He could easily talk to a Jew from Borough Park and a Jew from Texas. Tens of thousands owed their neshamas to him. Rabbi Lou Noman, my great uncle, my grandmother's brother, who worked very closely in Torah Masorah for many, many years, spoke at the funeral. He said, Dr. Joe was selected for the task of implementing the dream of Shai Defaivo to dot the American continent with Hebrew day schools. The American Rosh Yeshiva were the guiding force behind the movement, and Rabbi Kamenetsky worked with all of them. He used his incredible talents for chinuch. So we see that he was an extraordinary individual for whom we owe such a debt of gratitude. The average day school graduate today may never have even heard his name, but there wouldn't be the day school movement that we know. From literally a handful that you could count on 2 hands, to over 600 day schools across this country, the professionalism of Jewish education and the high level of Jewish education, the access to Jewish education, and Jewish education guaranteeing Jewish continuity and a bright Jewish future, it is all a tribute to him. Something he was only able to do because he could blend the best of his American upbringing, his university education, his commitment to Hapoel Mizrahi, and his relationship with Gedolei Yisrael, and a commitment to Torah. So much for us to learn from, so much for us to be grateful for. Thank you so much for coming to me.